Hey, welcome back, everyone. I'm George Knapp, your host for Coast to Coast tonight. We're talking with Tim Good, the British author of Need to Know and many other UFO bestsellers, about a secret war against the aliens. He believes that there's substantial evidence that we've been in a shooting war against whoever is flying these UFOs around, and they've been shooting at us and we've been shooting at them. You know, Tim, we'll get back to some specifics. I guess what I'd be wondering is, you know, given the fact that that from everything we know about UFOs, wherever they're from, other planets or dimensions or whatever, that they're so far technically advanced, so far beyond what we have, why haven't they just wiped us out? If we're shooting at them, they're shooting at us, you'd presume they could do a lot more damage than they've done.
Absolutely. I agree with you. And this makes me very skeptical about the whole possibility. But at the same time, there have been incidents where we have shot at these craft and in some cases have brought them down, certainly in the early days. My understanding is that that even our technology has been developed to the extent that we now have very, very capable weaponry to deal with some craft, but I'm quite sure that they could wipe us out if they wanted to. No question about it.
Well, you know, maybe then you get into stories like about Area 51 and Bob Lazar and Phil Corso and things like that, that we've been able to recover this technology. Maybe we've lessened the gap over the years.
Exactly. That's absolutely. I'm with you 100% on that one, George. No question.
I want to go back to this incident with these two military pilots. This is incredible to me. They fly up to interview Kenneth Arnold, the guy who started the modern UFO era. He saw these nine flying discs, I think it was, over saucer-like objects in over Washington State. You know, the first big story of the modern UFO era. The military pilots who go up to interview him, flying back, and they crash and die?
Yeah, well, there's this mysterious guy called Fred Chrisman, who was a mysterious character, definitely with a background in counterintelligence, which included U.S. Air Force and the CIA, including black operations for the CIA, who had investigated and, in my opinion, contaminated the case. And he is the one. Chrisman came in, he intervened, and there was Kenneth Arnold and Captain Smith when they were being interviewed by these Air Force intelligence officers. Chrisman gave the officers a box containing, you know, huge chunks of the recovered fragments of this sort of metal-like stuff, which was seen falling from the sky from six flying objects, which were seen above Puget Sound in Washington. I mean, I won't go into all the case here, but it happened in Maury Island, and there were many witnesses on a boat, and definitely stuff was coming down out of the sky from one of these craft, which appeared to be in trouble. And the materials were loaded onto this B-25 at McCord Field, Army Airfield, and there's some evidence. Kenneth Arnold says that the materials looked rather different from the aluminum-type metals that he and Ed Smith had been shown previously by Chrisman. So I think probably Chrisman switched some of those samples. Whatever the case, the plane crashed. It caught fire. Officially, just one of the engines caught fire. But the emergency firefighting system failed to work. The pilots never followed. Some of the crew members ordered some of the passengers to bail out, but the pilots never followed. The pilots did not notify anyone signifying the problem, and it's not known why they didn't parachute out as well. So it's a very mysterious case, definitely. And interestingly, Chrisman crops up in a number of incidents involving counterintelligence and UFOs. And he was allegedly one of the three tramps arrested. You remember in the Kennedy assassination?
There was
a photograph of these so-called tramps. And Fred Chrisman was one of those people. So that, I find that very interesting.
That just blows me away. I mean, I can't believe that I've never read that before until I saw it in your book here, that Chrisman could have been one of those guys and has been involved in UFO counterintelligence all these years. That's pretty weird.
Yeah.
Let's talk about for a minute about the D.C. overflights. In July 1952, it's one of the most famous UFO episodes ever. series of UFOs seen over Washington, sensitive areas, over the Capitol. Military jets are scrambled. They go after these things. They can't catch them. That's the official story becomes, oh, the radar operators who saw these things, it was just caused by a temperature inversion.
That's right.
Give me your take on that story and tell the audience the kinds of new information that you've acquired for this book that puts it in a different light.
Well, just, you know, to take one example, the sort of general impression one gets is that these were just blobs in the sky and they sometimes showed on radar and other times not. But in fact, sometimes quite large objects were seen quite clearly, such as there was one object about 100 feet long which hung in the air. Cigar-shaped craft. This was leading up to Washington, the D.C. sightings, and then at one stage, shortly after, objects were seen heading towards D.C. Over 500 people on the ground observed this strange object hovering north-northwest of the city, including a physics professor from George Washington University who says that during the 8 minutes this object was in sight, it came down so low that downtown buildings were obscured from his view. So that, I find, an interesting aspect of the D.C. sightings, that one actually came down that low.
You talked about these giant craft. I think I can't remember where it is exactly in the book, but I thought it was in relation to the Washington, D.C. Yes. Overflights, where these things like the giant craft from Independence Day or something were way up in the sky.
That's absolutely right. This is according to Major Donald Kehoe, who was a hero of mine, and he was responsible indirectly for stimulating my interest in the subject back in 1955. He discovered that during the period UFOs were being tracked in the D.C. area, gigantic objects were tracked orbiting Earth. Two of them, he says, came down between Washington and Baltimore and hovered at around 79,000 feet. And this is what he told journalist Bob Pratt, whom I knew is a very, very good journalist. This is what Kehoe says. I talked with one of the pilots who was in the jet squadron that was trying to get up near one of those things, and he said, "I've never been more terrified in my life. Just to look at that thing, you could tell that you'd be crazy to go up there and try and shoot at it. Thank God we couldn't get up that close." Later on, he had a friend who told me, "Yeah, I was there, and I was scared too. I don't know any of the pilots that were involved who weren't scared just seeing those huge damn things." Like that.
But it is sort of like the imagery from Independence Day, those gigantic mile-long ships, and the smaller ones would, yeah. Okay, Tim, we're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to talk about some of the comments from pilots about the D.C. overflights, what they weren't told and when they were sent up to go against these things. I'm George Knapp on Coast to Coast AM. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Coast AM, everyone. I'm George Knapp. I jumped the gun there a little bit. We're talking with Tim Good. And the author of a book called Need to Know about military encounters with UFOs. And, Tim, we were talking about the July 1952 overflights of Washington when a lot of American warplanes were sent up to pursue these UFOs, these objects. In your book, you mentioned that the pilots there are some comments from pilots who are very upset that they weren't told the truth about what they were going up there to chase, right?
Yep.
Would you elaborate on what it was, what their concerns were? I mean, were they close enough to see these things to be concerned about what it was that they're going up against?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I'm quite sure that footage was taken with gun cameras at that time, but the whole thing had to be downplayed. There's absolutely no question about this, and so the pilots were very unhappy that a lot of their reports were being publicly discredited when they knew that all these things were going on. And we know that, General Benjamin Chidlaw, who was former commanding general of what was then called Air Defense Command, said, in 1953 that we take this stuff seriously when you consider we have lost many men and planes trying to intercept them. And this, of course, is one of the big secrets. And it was confirmed. I mentioned the statistics of the 1,773 unexplained accidents from 52 to 56. According to Leonard Stringfield, whom I knew, a great researcher and former Air Force intelligence officer, he was told by a reliable source at that time that the Air Force was losing about a plane a day to the UFOs. And that absolutely tallies with the Defense Department statistics, which published in my book for the first time, thanks to Richard Hall and his informant, Dr. Fontes in Brazil.
You know, I remember reading your book, Above Top Secret, long ago, and there was a photo of Winston Churchill in there and a quote from him as saying, you know, ordering the Ministry of Defense, I guess, hey, what's the deal on the UFOs? But until I read this new book, I didn't understand the context. His comments were inspired by the D.C. overflights, or was it something else?
Yes, it was by the D.C. overflights, absolutely. What does all this stuff about flying saucers mean? You know, what's the truth? Let me have a report at your convenience. That's off the top of my head. It was something like that, and they came back, Prime Minister, don't worry. We've made an investigation in conjunction with the Americans. They were referring, of course, to the top-secret Flying Saucers Working Party, as it was called in Great Britain, wonderful title, which was established in 1950. For 1 year, they liaised with the Americans, and the object of the exercise, in my opinion, was the Americans were trying to get the Brits to discredit as many, especially the really good caliber sightings coming from pilots. I mean, we had sightings here in the very early 50s, prior to Washington, that there were sightings over Farnborough. Sort of major test pilots were seeing these things at Farnborough, the Royal Aircraft Establishment at Farnborough in Hampshire. And at low level, a craft came right over. I've described this in the book, came right over the airfield, seen by many officers, including these test pilots, on the ground. And this thing wasn't, it was at about, I don't know, no more than 1,000 feet, something like that. And it was metallic. It was making crackling sounds. There was a smell of ozone. There was a humming sound, and so on and so forth. And when the people from the Flying Saucers Working Party came to investigate, they took details very seriously and everything. And officially, the report was that the pilots had mistaken just conventional aircraft. So they were discredited. They were absolutely livid when they found out later on when the British government released some of these reports about the British flying saucers.
Wasn't there something involving Lord Mountbatten? He had an interest in the phenomena. Maybe something about something landing at his home.
Absolutely, yes. This was in the mid 1950s. I think it was around 1955, 56, when, according to one of his staff, a craft came down and a sort of section lowered from it, and a humanoid was seen. And this witness was actually sort of knocked off his bicycle in shock. It was in snow at that time, and he was encouraged to tell his boss, Lord Mountbatten, who came out to the site with him and saw the tracks of the bicycle where it had come down and everything. And Mountbatten believed that story. It's just one of many such stories. And that, I think certainly that inspired his interest, though I'm quite sure, according to my information, Mountbatten had a sighting in the Pacific Ocean during World War II.
I remember, and maybe it's from this book, maybe it's from an earlier book, that there was some suspicion that Mountbatten may have been a source for Dorothy Kilgallen, the American journalist who was pursuing the UFO mystery.
I wouldn't be at all surprised. I don't know for sure, but I think it's quite likely.
While we're on the subject of British UFO incidents and famous cases, the Rendlesham Forest case. I don't know if you heard earlier today in this program, I mentioned that Jacques Vallée had been in town here with the Remote Viewers Association, and I'd read something from Dr. Vallée about Rendlesham. He said that he was suspicious about that case because he believes that radar operators at this military base near where this incident had occurred had been told a couple of days beforehand, hey, keep an eye on the sea or what's going to come from the sea, his suspicion being that it may have been a manufactured incident. What's your take?
Well, Well, I don't know is the answer to that. I mean, that may there may be some truth in that. What I can tell you is that about 10 days prior to the craft coming down, because Roswell, Rendlesham Forest case, which involved the twin U.S. Air Force bases of Bentwaters and Woodbridge, took place starting on sort of Christmas night, 25, 26, 27, 20. It was going on for several nights. And whatever it was, this thing came right down so low that the U.S. Air Force security policemen actually were able to touch it at one stage with their feet. They were following it around the forest. I mean, it's an incredible case. And Nick Pope, who headed the UFO department in the Ministry of Defense from 1991 to 1994, he's absolutely convinced that this was from somewhere else. And at one stage, unofficially, at one stage, this craft, or one of the craft, was beaming down lights at the nuclear weapons storage area at these U.S. Air Force bases. And there were more nuclear weapons stored in Suffolk, in Great Britain, than anywhere else in Europe at that time, in December of 1980. But I'd also like to add, George, that on the 15th of December, this is 10 days prior to Woodbridge Bentwaters, an identical craft was seen right over my area. I saw it myself, not for long, unfortunately, and it was one of those rare occasions when I didn't have a camera with me or a movie camera. But I did see this brilliant point of light in the sky, and I wondered what on earth it was. It didn't seem like an aircraft. It was completely cloudless sky. But to cut a long story short, the next day I was told by a journalist that many people had seen for an hour and a quarter at least an object in the sky, and they were with binoculars. It was an elongated sort of triangular thing. Frequently, sections would come away from it and then regroup, and it would dart around the sky and then stay in one position for many minutes. And I'm sure that's the identical description of the craft that was seen in Bentwaters Woodbridge 10 days later. So I don't know about that story from Valet, but I can add that part to it. And video film was actually taken of that craft as well. Unfortunately, video was in its infancy in 1980. So the zoom range was very restricted. So there's not, you can't really see that much apart from a brilliant point of light.
But Tim, you're killing me. You had a UFO sighting?
Oh, sure. And as I say, when I got home, actually, I mean, because I've got, you know, cameras, zoom lenses, movie, the whole lot, telescope. Of course, that very minute, the thing decided to disappear. I swear they knew I was coming.
You're killing me. I mean, as long as I've been in this field, I've never seen anything remotely like a UFO, and I'm jealous, man.
Well, if only I had you know, binoculars and everything else with me, then we would have got some. I could have got some great pictures, possibly.
Back to the Rendlesham Forest thing for just a moment. You know, I have great respect for Dr. Valet, and suspect that maybe he knows a little something there. But if this were in fact a manufactured incident, a counterintelligence move, or a debunking move, you know, it was done at a top secret military base. It was never meant to be made public, and it took a heck of a lot of effort to get any of the details out into the public arena. So, it's hard to figure out what they would have been doing.
Charles Holt, who was the deputy base commander of both the twin Air Force bases at that time, and interestingly, he lives in Woodbridge, Virginia, which I find amusing. And he was absolutely livid, and I discussed this with him in person. He said, you know, this is your government's business. It didn't happen on our territory. It happened in Rendlesham Forest, which is just outside the twin Air Force bases. You know, it's your problem. And he never got any kind of response from the Ministry of Defense at all about it. So you would have thought, if that was a counterintelligence exercise, as Valley suggests, you would think that the deputy base commander at least should have been informed of the event.
Absolutely. Tim Good, stick around. We've got another half an hour of conversation with Tim, and then later on we'll be opening it up to your questions. I'm George Knapp on Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Knapp. I'm talking with author Timothy Good, who has written this new book, blockbuster book, Need to Know. Tim, a lot of you in the audience may not know that Tim played an important role, a critical role, in one of the most controversial UFO subjects of modern times, and that's the MJ-12 controversy, the MJ-12 documents. He was one of the first to see these documents. The controversy has erupted again, if you've seen the latest edition of the MUFON Journal. And when we come back after this short break, I'm going to ask Tim about his role in this and where he falls in terms of the ongoing controversy between Brad Sparks and Stanton Friedman. So stick around. We'll be right back with Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back, everyone. I'm George Knapp. This is Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with British author Tim Good, whose new book, Need to Know, fascinating new insight into the worldwide UFO cover-up. Tim, you know, I'm a journalist. I'm not a philosopher. I can't even begin to try to figure out what is in the minds of these aliens, where they're from, why they're here. But there are some things that, as a journalist, I can follow, and that's the paper trail. There are, as you know better than anyone, perhaps, there's a solid paper trail, government documents, secret reports, secret statements and memos from our military and our government, your military and your government. These are documents that were never meant to be seen by the public, which describe the military's true take on UFOs and this mystery. You include a lot of these documents in this book, Need to Know, including this Nathan Twining memo, September of 1947, in which he basically says these UFOs are real, right?
Oh, yes. I mean, there's nothing spectacular about that, but I mean, that's official. You know, the phenomenon is real and not something visionary or fictitious. That's what Twining said, and that is the official military position, and I'm surprised that more people don't cite that. I mean, that goes back to September of 1947.
What are there in your research? What are the most telling, provable, genuine documents from the inside that indicate what's really going on?
Oh my goodness, I wouldn't know where to start, George. I mean, there's so many. One of the things that's published for the first time in my book is a British report, which was only released by the Ministry of Defence last year. And this relates to sightings in March of 1993 in the Midlands, the central part of the United Kingdom. And there were two Royal Air Force bases at RAF Shawbury and RAF Cosford, which were penetrated by unknown objects, and these were the very large triangular type. And I've got two pages of this report, which is dated April of 1993, and it says that some of the reports state that the object was moving at a very high speed, while some say it was hovering or moving very slowly. Many of the reports refer to the object being very large, flying low, and making a low humming sound. My staff have spoken to a number of the military and police witnesses, many of whom commented that the object was unlike anything they had ever seen before. And the meteorological officer at RAF Shawbury reported seeing the object projecting a narrow beam of light at the ground at a height of 400 to 500 feet, and estimated the size of this object at somewhere between a C-30, it's a cargo plane, and a Boeing 747. When it passed over his head at an estimated 4,000 feet. And it continues, it concludes, in summary, there would seem to be some evidence on this occasion that an unidentified object or objects of unknown origin was operating over the UK. And so it goes on. So documents like that, I think, are fairly conclusive, in my opinion, at any rate.
You have one in this book, a 1949 Air Force intelligence report talking about multiple intrusions over military bases, nuclear bases, yes, things of that sort. That's another telling one. Yes. We've seen memos as late as the 1960s where Air Force higher-ups put out these orders that indicate that UFOs are, quote, serious business.
Yes, I've got the actual – I've reproduced the actual order that was posted on all United States continental Air Force bases, saying just how seriously this subject, you know, saying that the press ridicule it, but this must be rapidly identified as serious Air Force business, and it goes on and on. I mean, again, this is all official stuff from your government, acknowledging that we're dealing with a reality here, and I'm surprised that the press don't pick up on this more often. But let me say, talking about the press, George, I think listeners should know that, if they don't know already, that there was a big article in the Post, Washington Post, Sunday 21st, yesterday, that is my time. And I'd like to know whether it's actually in the newspaper itself or just online. But there's for the first time, I think, in the Post in recent years, there's a serious article by Joe Heim, Washington Post staff writer. It's called In the Orbit of UFO Enthusiasts. It's been posted on the net. I get it via Google Alert.
Yeah, I've read it. Yep.
You read it. It talks about Bob Swiatek and a lot of serious researchers. And there's not much of an element of ridicule about it, and I'm very impressed by this. I have sort of posted a comment to Joe Heim, but I haven't heard anything back yet. You know, but
we have these this paper trail. It's very telling. It's very serious, and it sort of paints it in black and white that there really is something going on, and our military has known about it for a long time. But one reason that the press people, reporters may have trouble pursuing this is because there are other documents that pop up from time to time that whose provenance is less solid. I mean, the MJ-12 documents.
You wanted to ask me about MJ-12.
I do. The reason it's timely now, I don't know if you've seen the current issue of the MUFON Journal, but you were there in Denver when Brad Sparks got up and delivered this scathing report about the MJ-12 documents and where they came from. His basic theory is that Stan Friedman, Bill Moore, Jamie Chandray were working on the Roswell story, doing all this research. At the same time, the information was being routed to the Air Force through Bill Moore, this agent named, intelligence officer named Rick Doty, and that he, in fact, was feeding it back to them in the form of these documents. He would take their information and create this. Where do you come down on this?
Well, first of all, let me say that, as you know, I was the first to publish the Majestic 12 documents.
Right.
I was amused to see Brad Sparks' comment that I received my copy from Rick Doty. That's absolute. So it makes me wonder, how much of the rest of his article is pure invention. That is not the case. I have never released the name of the person I did obtain my documents from, but it certainly wasn't Rick Doty. I've never even met him. I've never communicated with him. I've tried to meet him, but he's not interested. But as I have said in most of my books subsequent to Above Top Secret, I believe the documents are fraudulent, but that there was a Majestic 12 document, and that the whole purpose of the exercise, the people who fabricated the document, was to smoke out the real MJ-12, and they were successful in doing that because several people confirmed that there was a Majestic 12 or an MJ-12 or a Magic 12. Now, one of whom was Dr. Eric Walker, who was a British physicist and a Harvard graduate, and he was former executive secretary of the Research and Development Board, chairman of National Science Foundation's Committee for Engineering, and so on, and president of Penn State University. And this is in a recorded conversation with Bill Steinman in 1987, confirmed that he'd attended meetings at Wright-Patterson concerning the military recovery of flying saucers and occupants, and he confirmed the existence of MJ-12. So,
and would Sarbacher,
I beg your pardon?
Would Sarbacher, Robert Sarbacher, would he be on that short list of people who've confirmed it?
Yes. Not sort of directly, but certainly indirectly, and other people have confirmed that there was definitely a Magic 12 or an MJ-12. And I mentioned Andy Kistner, the former state representative for Las Cruces, who gave me a lot of information. He believes, and I've published it in the book, that the acronyms MAJIC and MJ-12 could have been formed from the Manhattan, short for Manhattan Engineering District, Joint Chiefs of Staff Integrated Command, Project Y of Division Z, Group 12. Now, I won't go into all that's all rather complex, but I was in touch with Sandia Laboratories historian, Rebecca Ulrich, for my research into all this, and she said she'd no records pertaining to anything like that, MJ-12, Magic 12, or Majestic. But I think another possibility suggested by Dr. Wood, who, of course, is very much involved in the Majestic controversies that MAJIC was formed from military assessment of the Joint Intelligence Committee, and that sounds quite possible as well. But it remains clear to me that there was definitely an organization of that name.
Tell me this. You mentioned that, you know, you're not going to tell us who your source is, where you got the MJ-12 documents from. You know it wasn't from Rick Doty. Is it at all possible that your source had some contact with Rick Doty, that Doty might have fed the documents to he or her?
I'm sure it's possible.
Okay. So do you believe that there's an MJ-12 now? Or something like it?
By whatever name, yes, I do, definitely.
Do you have any kind of proof, or is it just a feeling that
I don't have any proof, no.
More of a feeling that there would have to be someone that would handle this stuff?
Absolutely, no question about it.
What's your take on Colonel Phil Corso?
I think he's on the level. Unfortunately, he didn't check the manuscript before it was published, so there are a number of errors and things have been slipped in by his co-author, are not quite accurate. But I think essentially, yes, he was absolutely on the level. Moreover, people have tried to tell me that Corso had nothing to do with the National Security Council. This I've been able to disprove because I have the actual military papers which confirm that although he wasn't on the National Security Council itself, and maybe that was just part of the manuscript he didn't check in his book, he served on the intelligence staff of the National Security Council's Operation Coordinations Board, later known as the Special Group 5412, then Special Group 5412/2, which planned, coordinated, approved, and evaluated the most sensitive covert paramilitary and clandestine operations ever mounted by the United States government. So that's what Corso was doing. Top secret work as an intelligence officer at the National Council, but he didn't actually stand on the National Council, the Security Council itself.
Right. And now, you know, one of the main criticisms of Corso, he had said that technology, that materials from crashed or recovered saucers had been sort of filtered out to industry, to national labs and things of that sort.
In the early 60s.
And of course, the critics have said, "Nah, that's a bunch of baloney. We developed this stuff on our own. There's a paper trail to show where fiber optics and things like that came from."
Right. Well, Corso's take on that was he told a friend of mine who is very well informed. He told that person, scientist, that was not what his position was, that they actually farmed this stuff out to the American industrial corporations at a time when people were starting to work on this. So it wasn't as described in the book. So the critics are absolutely right, but Corso himself was very upset that that's the way it came across in the book, and it's not what he maintained.
You know, you and I, we started our conversation with talking about disclosure and how it might work and why it's unlikely. This topic came up while we were in Denver. You know, there are a lot of groups in the UFO field who are pushing for congressional hearings as if that would somehow be a revelation and it would be, you know, a smooth sailing after that. What's your take on congressional hearings? Possible, likely, unlikely, unproductive?
Listen, I've been involved for decades, periodically assisting congressmen, a number of your congressmen, in inquiries with the object of getting closed hearings. Each one of them has been stopped or has otherwise sort of ground to a halt, occasionally in suspicious circumstances. And I'm not going to go much further than that, except to say that Congress is sewn up. And there are not enough people with enough guts to pursue it because they will be discouraged, to put it that way.
They will be
discouraged from having anything like closed hearings with the object of opening up information.
I think I've spoken to some of the same people that you've spoken to. I know that there is interest among some elected members of Congress in this topic, but it's got to be on a very quiet level. And you know, just from a pure political standpoint, they'd be crucified for showing an interest in a topic that so many people think is goofy. The other thing I worry about is, and maybe you can comment on it as well, is the existence of highly vocal UFO groups who would raise hell if they were left out of any congressional hearing. And these are groups who have very controversial beliefs that are not even shared by most of the people in the UFO field, perhaps created specifically for the purpose of deterring congressional hearings.
Yeah, quite likely. I go along with you.
Tell me about the book now. Is it available here in the States now?
It was published on Friday, George. The 18th, anyway. When was the 18th? Was that Thursday, Friday? And it should be in the shops. I haven't had any reports yet otherwise, but it's overdue by quite a number of months. So I know people have been frustrated in trying to get it. And, of course, you can get it on Amazon. For a cheaper price and so forth, but it should be in the bookshops. And if there's any problem, you can put people in touch with me.
Need to Know: UFOs, the Military, and Intelligence by Tim Good. That's the book. Any chance you're going to do a book tour? You coming over here to speak?
I wish, but I can't afford it, believe it or not. Unfortunately, I'd love to do that, and I'm cooperating with my publisher as best I can in promoting the book, but I shall certainly be over in the States next year.
You're working on another book already, or can you tell us?
No, I'm still recovering from this one, clearing the debris, all the research material.
And is your publisher, I know this is a different publisher for you this time?
It is, yes. Pegasus Books of New York, and on my website there are details of how to contact them should any difficulties arise with obtaining books. And I can also send, if anyone wants me to send them the press release, I'd be glad to do that.
There's one other question.
I'd be glad to give any interviews in people's local towns or radio stations or whatever.
All right, there it is, folks. We're going to open this up to your questions for Tim Good in a minute. I've got time for one more, unrelated to the UFO cover-up stuff that we're discussing in your book, Need to Know. It's about Skinwalker Ranch, which is, of course, is something that I've written about, the Utah Ranch. And while we're researching the working on the book about the strange goings-on there, we come across your reference to a similar ranch in Colorado. I know it's been a while since you looked at this stuff. Can you remember enough details to know whether the comparison is valid?
I think very valid indeed. This I wrote in my book, I believe it was Alien Contact, the one in the States, and they called it Alien Liaison over here. I had a chapter on that. I think it was called Colorado Breakthrough, or just Breakthrough, I forget which, but I found that very interesting, particularly since there was a U.S. Air Force officer involved, and it wasn't that far from the U.S. Air Force base, and these Bigfoot sightings, all manner of strange things, and UFO sightings, and actual contacts with humanoid-type occupants, and I find that a very, very compelling case. So there are parallels with the Skinwalker business.
Any possibility that was some sort of a disinformation campaign or psychological exercise, or do you have an opinion?
Yes, it may well have been a psychological exercise, George, but, the question is who's perpetrating it? I mean, the aliens aren't above sort of befuddling us, and are they?
No, they are not, and neither is our government. Tim Good, good chatting with you, but stick around. We're going to open up our phone lines, and listeners, I hope you got your A game on and you got some good questions for Tim. We'll be right back in a couple of minutes. I'm George Knapp on Coast to Coast AM.